and Authority, Reemerging Mormon Feminism, to be published by Signature Books. This anthology is going to be a collection of recent papers about Mormon women, several of which have been individually published in local journals over the past 5 years. My purpose in producing this anthology is to provide, in one volume, several affirming, definitive discussions of Mormon women and authority, priestesshood, and God the Mother. My hope is that collectively, these pieces will illustrate and testify of the goddess-given authority which Mormon women possess. Some of the authors that will be featured in this anthology include Linda Newell, Carol Lynn Pearson, Linda Wilcox, Ian Barber, Edwin Firmage, Margaret Toscano, Marion Yates, Doris Elliott, Martha Pierce, Bella Evans, Michael Quinn, Meg Wheatley, Bettina Lindsay, and several others. Our panel today focuses upon a discussion of female authority as authorship, or authority as the act of describing experience, knowledge, and being. Each of us has selected excerpts from our papers to share with you today. Bella Neal Evans is an adjunct assistant professor of communications at the University of Utah, and she also teaches in the Women's Studies program there. She has taught and will be teaching this winter quarter a course entitled Women in Mormon Culture, and she encourages those of you who are interested in the course to please come and sign up. She'll be talking today from her paper, Patterns of Empowerment in the Mormon Women's Publications, and she will address historical precedent for female authority as authorship. I will follow Bella Evans with my comments from the introduction to my anthology, and will attempt to present some theory of female authority as authorship. Martha Pierce will then present her comments. She is an attorney and a new mother who back in 1982 was the first person I knew to speak about praying to or interacting with God the Mother as a real person. She will share excerpts from her paper, Personal Discourse on God the Mother, which illustrates one immediate avenue for exercising female authority as authorship. We hope you enjoy these comments and the panel today, and any remaining time that we have after our comments, we'll turn over to you for any questions that you might have.
Discourse is powerful. Written or spoken, formal or informal, it communicates the belief system from which it springs. Individual statements reflect the understanding of an individual speaker or writer, but an official body of discourse discloses the facts, values, and policies that distinguish one culture from another. In addition, discourse both reflects and directs perception, as authoritative statements define and identify the members of a society and teach the values that will perpetuate the culture and establish social policy. Throughout most of Western history, males and females have been defined in different terms and given different roles. Prevailing images of male strength and agency, female nurturance and dependency, have been reproduced in life experience. In patriarchal religious communities, where gender dichotomy is the most extreme, a male god directs experience by speaking through male prophets to be reinterpreted by male priests in a male-based religious structure. Thus, male power and perceptions become self-reflexive and self-perpetuating. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is such a patriarchal religion. During the first 40 years of church history, female members had only one official and truly public voice, the Nauvoo Relief Society, which met between 1842 and 1844. During its early months, the membership rose to over 1,000 women. Large outdoor meetings were convened and the proceedings were recorded. Otherwise, from the time when the church was organized in 1830 until it was well established in the Great Basin, Mormon women were defined exclusively by male leaders to meet Old Testament standards of industry, fecundity, purity, piety, and submission to their husbands. These evaluations and directives were spoken in church meetings and printed and read in church papers and other publications, including the Millennial Star and the Journal of Discourses. Thus, men's perceptions of women were generally well known, but the women had no such public forum. In 1872, however, Brigham Young concluded that an official women's publication could be useful in order to collect a history of the women of the church, exchange messages between the general officers of Relief Society and the wards and branches, and perhaps primarily to provide a platform for women's defense of polygamy. Thus, the Women's Exponent came into being. In 1889, Susie Young Gates established the Young Woman's Journal, the official magazine for young adult women of the church, including the Young Ladies Mutual Improvement Association. And in 1914, the Woman's Exponent became known as the Relief Society magazine. Mormon Women's official published discourse has been relatively limited in quantity and read almost exclusively by women. However, for 98 years of the church's 160-year history, Mormon women owned, controlled, and published at least one, and sometimes two, official church publications. I contend that such publications empowered the sisters by providing vehicles for self-expression and self-definition, including the most complex and positive images of women available in Mormon discourse. Though the sisters' journals defined women as passive, compliant, dependent, and virtuous, they also defined women as independent and strong. Though the early exponent did indeed support polygamy, and all of the journals have promoted marriage, large families, good housekeeping, and church service, the sisters' publications also promoted a wide range of religious, secular, and domestic options for women. The comparatively liberal dimension of the women's journals was found in editorial policy, authorship, content, and style. Prominent Mormon women published essays, biographies, and poetry, and the Exponent exchanged articles with the Boston Woman's Journal, a prestigious feminist publication edited by Lucy Stone. For many years, the Woman's Exponent carried as its masthead this slogan, "The rights of the women of Zion and the rights of women of all nations." And it promised to speak freely on the topics that interested women. Following staff changes in 1923, the Relief Society magazine, which replaced the Exponent, restated its purpose to, quote, "endeavor to place before its readers stories of real achievement, particularly as they're reflected in the lives of women," and noted that, fortunately, such events were not confined to the lives of men. In 1889, editor Susie Young Gates said that the magazine, the Young Woman's Journal, was her girl's own magazine and designed to recognize women who had received name and fame among our people and to bear a message of freedom to every daughter of woman. Early issues of the Woman's Exponent and Young Woman's Journal indicated that Mormon women of that period held some degree or form of priesthood, which enabled general auxiliary leaders to direct the larger community of sisters, while local leaders had local autonomy. In addition, Eliza R. Snow reported in the Woman's Exponent that any faithful, endowed Mormon woman was worthy to wash, anoint, and lay hands on the sick. The journal described Lucy Bigler Young, a plural life to Brigham Young, as a woman whose words of inspiration and personal prophecy flowed like a stream of living fire. The journal also claimed that the power of God under Sister Young's hands had enabled the crippled to walk, the barren to give birth, and myriad other healings. Early Mormon women also defined a much more active political role for themselves than is currently the case. In 1873, the Exponent observed, "A few truthful, honorable women in Congress wouldn't hurt, but would help it." From 1880 to 1920, Mormon women lobbied for national woman suffrage and devoted auxiliary meetings to suffrage activities. The Woman's Exponent and Young Woman's Journal reported these events and urged greater effort. After Utah achieved statehood in 1896, Mormon women held elected office, and the sisters' publications applauded their success. During the 1920s, the sisters' interest in American social policy and their own paraprofessional social work was also reported in their journals. The 19th century Exponent, the Turn of the Century Journal, and to a lesser degree, the pre-World War II magazine also supported wage employment for women, even though male church leaders typically did not and do not. In 1877, the Exponent claimed that every job that opened for women was a blessing and urged girls to undertake the real work. In addition, both the Journal and the Exponent supported women who worked for personal as well as financial needs and both assumed that women could manage two careers. The exponent affirmed, "It has been the popular cry that no woman could be a good, true, loving wife and at the same time successfully follow any profession. If so, neither can a man do justice to any professional calling and prove a kind, affectionate, and loving husband." More surprisingly, even though authoritative male discourse has consistently and unequivocally mandated motherhood for women, in 1873, the woman's exponent printed the following: "There may be some women in whom the love of learning extinguishes all other love. Then the heaven-appointed sphere of that woman is not the nursery. It may be the library, the laboratory, the observatory." Roughly 15 years later, Lizzie Smith told younger readers that the female should have perfect liberty to follow the profession which comes to her from God, and of which she alone is judge. The women's publications also lent support to women's paid employment by featuring examples of women's wage work. In 1938, the magazine recognized Antonia Brico, director of the New York Women's Orchestra, Mae Briggs, who earned $10,000 a year as postmistress of Los Angeles, and Bessie Pastor, who manufactured a synthetic ice that was perfect for skating. The journal recognized a woman minister in Africa and a female postal express writer who was young, plucky, pretty, a good shot, a good talker, purely Western product. Employment options were also suggested in short feature articles. In 1917, the magazine observed that Columbia and Harvard medical schools finally accepted women because they proved very clever with the work. Clever, ladies. Years later, the magazine admonished Mormon women to remain at home during World War II, but at the same time praised non-Mormon women who worked in the defense industries, left prestigious academic ranks to head up the women's services, or enlisted in the Corps. Such apparent inconsistency might confuse some readers, but ambiguity can empower as it expands options and promotes personal choice. For most of its history, the Young Woman's Journal provided an even more impressive range of options. Notable women scientists, scholars, educators, and innovators were recognized in full-length articles. In the early years of the 20th century, the journal printed several series featuring women entrepreneurs, sovereigns, suffragettes, writers, and artists who might serve as role models for younger readers. Other writing was more prescriptive and more direct. For example, in 1929, the journal quoted the following with apparent approval: "Many writers of today advocate the advisability of women continuing in their active outside profession even during the period when they are giving their best efforts to home and family." The earliest of the sisters' publications also challenged traditional domestic relationships. In 1874, the woman's exponent complained that most men considered their wives to be little more than a convenience, who would manage his house, cook his dinner, attend to his wardrobe, always on hand if needed, and always out of sight if not. She is a subject, not a partner, in their joint domestic firm. In 1890, the journal contested the marriage mandate, even though male leaders claimed that unmarried members would be denied the highest salvation. In the first volume of the Young Woman's Journal, Lucinda Dalton claimed that the wise Mormon girl would wait to marry until she had a suitable opportunity, but she was resolved to remain single rather than marry an inferior man. The exponent also challenged traditional relationships. In 1874, it stated, "All honor and reverence to good men, but they and their attentions are not the only source of happiness on earth." And 2 years later, the same publication adopted a similar tone: "Woman is terribly in earnest. She is no longer willing to be trammeled by narrow conventionalities, but to step forward on a broader platform." The exponent later advised women to train themselves to stand upon just as grand and elevated a platform as men. And in 1890, the Young Woman's Journal claimed, "Where woman is the stronger, she takes the precedence of man." An empowering contrast to the notion of man as head and woman as helpmeet. After World War I, direct male influence increased gradually in the sisters' publications, and the women published fewer non-traditional directives. However, female independence continued in the guise of attractive role models. For example, in her literature lessons, Alice Louise Reynolds termed Georgia Eliot heroic. The Mormon Journal also praised such noted radicals as Madame de Stael, Methodist minister Anna Shaw, and feminist theorist Elizabeth Cady Stanton. The publication defined Susan B. Anthony as humanity's uncrowned queen, while Mary Wollstonecraft was cited as a just reformer. All of the sisters' publications praised the strength of women homesteaders who built homes, fenced lands, raised crops, and battled nature. During the first third of the 20th century, both the magazine and the journal published long biographies of prominent and professional women. Two decades later, the magazine extolled volunteer service, home arts and crafts, and dependent femininity in the prosperous 50s. Though post-World War II women leaders essentially reproduced the male paradigm, they were still visible as editors and writers responsible for the magazine, and this presence alone empowered some women. But in June of 1970, a black-bordered notice appeared in the Relief Society magazine stating that, in compliance with the directive of the First Presidency, the magazine would finish its career with a December issue. Marion Sharp's final editorial concluded, "As we detail and recall nostalgic memories, we still, obedient to the priesthood and receiving direction from them, face forward in step with the new era of the 1970s with anticipation and a sense of dedication and support for the all-adult magazine. Morituri salutamus. We salute you in death." According to Apostle Thomas S. Monson, church-wide changes after World War II were necessary to complete the goal set by the Priesthood Correlation Program to offset competition among the auxiliaries and correlate forces in combating evil. The Relief Society magazine was one fatality of this effort. While both the Woman's Exponent and Young Woman's Journal had earlier struggled with insufficient funds before being absorbed by other church publications. In addition, I conclude that increasing male influence in the women's publications from 1920 to 1970 reduced the publishing options for the sisters. From 1872 to 1914, the Woman's Exponent was edited, printed, and written by women, with no man serving on an editorial board or acting in an official advisory capacity. The magazine replaced the Exponent in 1914, and by 1920, 10% of the bylined essays in the magazine's table of content were written by men. By 1934, 20%. By 42, 30%. By 1952, 33% of the signed articles and 60% of the bylined lessons were written by men. By 1956, 33% of the articles and 75% of the lessons were written by men. Women wrote only the homemaking lesson and the visiting teacher's message. After 1961, men wrote roughly 50% of the signed feature articles. Titles used in referring to women leaders also eroded. Prophetesses, frequently applied to early Relief Society presidents, and priestess, used to define women temple workers, disappeared from usage, and presidentess became the gender-neutral president. As a result of these changes, female programs and leaders appeared less significant in contemporary discourse. The women's publications and the church also lost the presence of women with perceived real power. The first generation of these leading sisters had roots in the 19th century, were widely known and revered, and their discourse deemed authoritative. Many of the second generation of women leaders were related to or friends of powerful male leaders, and thus had influence through their associations. Most of these strong women leaders were gone by the 1930s, however, and church politics have not been as amenable to women's influence since that time. It's also interesting to note that the Mormon women's image has been relatively strong and complex in inverse relationship to the strength of the image of the church itself. Currently, Mormon women serve in editorial and writing positions for the adult and young adult women's magazines, church magazines, and for the Church News, weekly supplement to the Deseret News. However, the Mormon woman's image as image maker is greatly reduced, and the cultural image of women is constricted. Men manage and write essentially all authoritative discourse in Mormonism. All official texts are prepared under the direction of the Priesthood Correlation Committee, including the girls' and women's lesson materials and other communications. Women are empowered as they express themselves authentically. Women are also empowered as they read other women's public statements and thereby recognize their own expressive rights and social validity. In addition, women are empowered as they are defined with a relatively extended range of acceptable characteristics and options. Such a range reflects the complexity and diversity of women's lives and implies trust in women's ability to choose appropriately for themselves. In 1883, the Woman's Exponent affirmed these principles. There is no better method of communication between any people engaged in any public enterprise than that of a newspaper. And until women talk to each other freely in this way and express their views and feelings, no great tangible change will take place in the advancement of the masses of women. Contemporary Mormon women lack the official public voice that was available to earlier sisters. As a result, I think they also lack the authority and empowerment that those women enjoyed. In partial response to this situation, unofficial publications such as Exponent 2, the Mormon Women's Forum newsletter, Women's Writing in Sunstone and Dialogue, and other collections have provided a means of self-definition while still supporting church membership. When women are defined more narrowly inside their church than out of it, however, some seek non-church avenues for support. And if the spirit of the self-defining Mormon woman becomes lost, what effect will that have on a church whose strong women have empowered the institution itself? Perhaps a final thought from the woman's exponent is appropriate in response. The editor of the Exponent writing, "I sometimes think it would be well if the brethren would read our paper more than they do and become better acquainted with the sisters' feelings and desires, and perhaps we could work to one another's interest better than we do now."
Mormon women are again waxing uppity in large numbers. A critical mass is forming. Mormon feminism, coupled with the knowledge of the Mother in Heaven, are sweeping active Mormons into discourse about women in Mormonism. More and more feminist papers, speeches, and views are constantly emerging in public and private settings. These illuminating voices and views represent personal revelation and the beginnings of change. They generate reformation. They are a collective theology, an emerging Mormon theology. For many, this phenomenon is the working of a non-hierarchical revelation. Women opposed to priesthood for women can no longer say that those women in favor are a small, wrong-headed, irreverent minority, and perhaps they never were. When I was called to be a Mormon missionary in June of 1978, I did not feel irreverent or wrong-minded. I was devoted to God and the Mormon Church, and I wanted a priestly calling. I gave my best to my 19-month ordination, yet I was unable to lead a zone, baptize converts, heal the sick. But I did give blessings of comfort to some and turned down all other requests for spiritual duties. In spite of my desire to perform them, my ordination as a minister of the church, and my endowment with the holy garment of the priesthood. The purpose of this anthology is to address the issue of Mormon women and priesthood. And central to any discussion of Mormon women and priesthood is a discussion of authority and feminism. Feminism is often misunderstood and even feared in Mormonism. The term feminism reportedly originated in 1851, and it derives from the Latin femina, meaning woman, and ism, condition of being or philosophy, and means simply the condition or philosophy of being female. Feminism is not simply one philosophy, doctrine, or movement. There have been many feminist philosophies and movements, from the ancient matriarchal traditions to the medieval feminist texts to the campaigns of Jeanne d'Arc and the writings of 15th, 18th, and 20th century feminists. At least six distinct movements have appeared in the U.S. since the turn of the century. The first, Enlightenment, liberal feminism, from approximately 1790 to 1860, advocated the natural rights of women, authority of individual reason, equality of the sexes, and rational legal concerns such as the right to vote. It was voiced through women like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, Susan B. Anthony, and Abigail Adams. Cultural feminism, from approximately 1845 to 1920, asserted matriarchal vision, inherent female-oriented values and spheres, such as the feminization of nature, intuition, distinct maleness and femaleness, global peace, clean environment, female healing, female clergy, birth control, and the evils of patriarchy. It surfaced through the publications such as Mrs. Stanton's The Woman's Bible, which attested to the existence of a Heavenly Mother and the equation of women's importance with priesthood. These two feminist movements constitute the first wave of feminism in America. In the 20th century, we have Marxist socialist feminism formed around the modern condition through application of labor, wage, and class discussions to female and racial spheres. During this shift, the Equal Rights Amendment was born in 1923. Freudian feminism from the turn of the century to the present arose due to Freud's observations of human interaction and his sexist theories about human psychosocial development. Freudian feminism pays unrelenting attention to psychology and object relations theory. French existentialist feminism from 1925 to the present derived from the French philosophical movement and elaborates on text, particularly as a tool for rewriting philosophical institutions. Radical feminism from 1966 to the present was developed by the 60s feminists in New York and Boston, partly as a reaction to the sexism of males in the New Left. It seeks to allow an authentic women's style, a distinct female epistemology. The new feminist moral vision, which is the most recent movement, is anti-Newtonian and departs from rationalism and duality. It embraces relativity and proposes a deconstructionist or post-structuralist criticism. These movements constitute the second wave of feminism in America. There seems to be a perception among contemporary Mormon conservatives that the influence of feminism on Mormon women has been from radical or so-called militant feminist views. Unfortunately, the rather consistent cause of Mormon feminists is actually most similar to the first feminist movement, the early 19th century struggle of the liberal cultural feminists. There are a number of reasons why Mormon women remain engaged in a feminist battle that is over 100 years old. Mormonism was born in the early 19th century and is characterized by the 19th century Newtonian Cartesian worldview, the 19th century pagan magical worldview, and the Judeo-Christian apocalyptic vision. Mormon attitudes about women arose from this 19th century kaleidoscope and became institutionalized. Thus, women are to some extent in Mormonism frozen in time, along with Mormon doctrine and theology in the early 19th century worldview. Mormon women are also insulated from non-Orthodox ideas by the absolutist nature of Mormon philosophy and doctrine. At least one former Mormon feminist, Marilyn Orensky, accused Mormon women of never having been feminists at all. But she made a mistake in comparing all Mormon feminist activities to her own contemporary 20th century feminist view. This helps to explain why 20th century Mormon feminists have generally had to fight the battle of their liberal cultural grandmothers. Mormon women, as feminist scholar Josephine Donovan fears for all women, keep reinventing the wheel. My sense is that the current wave of Mormon feminists have an advantage over previous Mormon feminists and movements. They are building on the progress made by their sisters. They seem to be moving beyond the battle of their Mormon grandmothers. They seem to be assuming liberal cultural feminism as a basic given and then moving beyond it to catch up to their own place in time in contemporary culture. They seem to lack fear of the unorthodox. They are refusing to reinvent the wheel. Although the pagan or magic worldview accounts for perhaps half of the Mormon temperament, Mormon doctrine and theology, rooted in rationalist views and absolutist positions of the Age of Reason, keep Mormons stuck there and able to make the leap of relativity. This is only one reason why feminism is vital to Mormonism. Feminists understand relativity, and they're leaping. Leaping from Newton to Einstein does not destroy the law, but fulfills it. Mormon feminists often talk in political terms of giving resistance and tension, of getting response and attention, all of which refer to women reacting and deferring to men and male authority. This discussion must simply be swept aside for being wrongly focused. Women's experience is central. Female action is the approach. The woman question is not a question. It is an answer. There are two general notions of authority: speaking for a group or speaking as an individual. Bruce R. McConkie defined priesthood as eternal power and authority of deity, delegated to man or woman, to act for the salvation of man or woman. He used man in the generic sense, and so I've added woman. Many people, especially women, are put off by the word authority and its acquired connotations. But the word's etymology reveals its positive meanings. Authority comes from the Latin word auctor, to create, and augere, to increase, to divine, to wax, to grow. The French socio-historical philosopher Michel Foucault addressed the two seemingly opposing notions of authority in much of his work by combining them as integrated aspects of an enormous web of relations. He thus derived a third dimension of authority or power as a dynamic which is self-existent, a network within which we are both recipients and executors, all related in a genealogy of power that permeates. This is not unlike the Mormon notion of priesthood or authority as power to be accessed. Foucault says that the individuals are the vehicles of power, not its point of application. Foucault also has much to say about discourse and language as the mediators, tools, or conveyors of power and authority. I see authority as the central issue confronting Mormon women, and I define feminism as female authorship. Instead of the executor-recipient model of Foucault, I propose one compatible to Foucault's model, the relationship between author and editor. Authorship is the exercise and discipline of conceptualization. Authors create and define, while a good editor critiques and assists the work to clarify and reveal its meaning. A good author does not impose his or her own authorship onto the text. For example, Joseph Smith authored, and Emma edited for him. I believe that Emma also attempted to author, but that Joseph did not edit for her. Women have been kept as editors, prevented from being authors. This is a very personal issue for me in particular. Women must change the terms of this discourse and assume authorship. Female authority must be assumed. I'm convinced that only female-devised and defined authority will endow women with personhood in Mormonism. Denying Mormon women their own authority or authorhood is equating them with children who are also denied authority. Casting the women with the children in Mormonism, especially in this century, has effectively marginalized a group comprised of well over half the total membership, or most of the body of Christ. It has also officially kept women in the perspective of a child in the child-parent relationship, preventing them from maturing. Though Mormon women generally have children of their own and advance to the parent role in society and develop leadership skills among women-only or auxiliaries, they remain the child in the religious community in the kingdom of God. To assume a different given, to automatically alter discourse by assuming something other than the widely accepted basic assumption, is authorship. To put ourselves, our own being, in the center of reality is authorship. The struggle of all feminism, including Mormon feminism, is the decision-making process, choosing which bits of traditional and non-traditional ways of being to retain. There is not one pure cohesive feminism or approach, only an unruly hybrid attempting to fuse the many parts into a whole. Each of us is complex and must shift. We must choose what we believe. We are all many little bits of isms, many moments of personal revelation and strategy, many choices and results. We are continually choosing what we will reject and retain of our own upbringing, our own culture, academic training, our religion, social customs, and relationships. The challenge is to keep these as personal choices and authorship, and not to be intimidated by the decisions or strategy of others, no matter how authoritative they may be. Women should not ask for, nor devise priesthood, nor priestesshood, we have repeatedly been told. God the prophet and apostles will tell us if and when Mormon women should have authority. The hypocrisy here is illustrated by a recitation of Mormonism's most fundamental doctrine, that we must ask of God, who giveth liberally. That revelation will not be given to us, but that we must first study it out in our own minds and then ask God if it be right. And if it is right, we will feel a burning. These scriptures are a prescription for authority. Many Mormon women have searched and asked and have received their answer. I believe that God gives authority to women directly. Men cannot give women the authority of God, and on some level, Mormon men and women know this. It would be the ultimate act of patriarchy. Men have assumed their authority and went about doing God's work, but women have doubted their own authority. In addition, it is problematic and unlikely for an official hierarchical revelation to occur for women in Mormonism, simply because there are no women formally authorized to receive revelation on behalf of the entire church. It is therefore fitting that goddesshood, priestesshood, and other related revelations come to women and in non-hierarchical flow. Although the recognized prophetess Eliza R. Snow reportedly attributed the Mother in Heaven doctrine as originated by Joseph Smith, she set the precedent by being the first to author the Mother in a text and thus reveal her to the rest of us. Joseph, I believe, actually revealed an ambiarchy, a blueprint, and then went on to author the male half of the Restoration. Women began authoring the female half, but sexist values of the 19th century left them often confused. I believe that Joseph did not finish the work. He did as much as he had time to do, and then he left the rest to us. Whether you adhere to Joseph Smith's earlier vision of God as Trinity and grace, or to his later, more refined Newtonian version of anthropomorphic exalted man, the work is unfinished, the text dynamic, the female unwritten. Mormonism needs a lot of editing, and the authorship of the female. Mormon women cannot petition men to wear the mantle of authority, nor should they attempt to defend wearing the mantle of authority. They must simply wear the mantle and wear it well. Many Mormon women wait for male restoration of goddess and priestesshood, and they wait for authority. But these have already come. The goddess has revealed herself to many, and priestesshood is her authority in which we share. For example, in late 1987 and early 1988, many Mormon women had personal visions of the goddess and came together to form the Mormon Women's Forum. There is currently an outpouring of goddess spirit, a modern Pentecost. The spirit of goddess, like a fire, is burning. Our task is not to wait, but to act now and fully on her behalf and ours. And as it was for Joseph, time for us is flying. The work is rolling forward and it will not stop. Mormon women are receiving authority one by one. As a grandchild of 22 Mormon pioneers who crossed the plains between 1847 and 1869, I am metaphysically and physically Mormon. But like Joseph Smith, my metaphysical hunger drove me to pursue the mystical in an unchecked context, the organic worldview, and to remove the institutional adhesions on my religious life in order to perceive the source of it, the goddess and God. Like Joseph, I found the divine through the ordinary, God through the pagan. I caught a vision beyond rationalism and paganism, alive and burning, autonomously in myself and many others, inherent yet inchoate in Mormonism. And I wonder if Mormonism can accept its own God, if Mormon women can form a new relationship. Many Mormon women and men are afraid to author their own being or to act because they don't feel qualified or authorized. We must explicitly describe our being, our work, our lives, our children, our longings, our revelations. We must see ourselves and our experiences valid. Our vehicles are our bodies, our authority, and our words. We need to edit existing text, scripture, ritual, worship, doctrine, and theology to include God the Mother and the female and ourselves. And we need to author our experiences of God the Mother, scriptures of the goddess, hymns to her glory, poetry, prayers to her love, holy books, rituals to approach her. We need God the Mother in our temples to welcome us into her presence. We need to author our own priestesshood, our own authority. We need to restore the Relief Society and its authority, women's lessons, text. The list goes on and on. Joseph Smith gave us a good example. He was a great author. If Mormonism is a living church with modern revelation, it contains the seeds of its own reinvention. If it is the restoration of all things, it contains a charge to restore the goddess to her mystical, metaphysical, social, and physical place. The time has come for Mormon women to say, "This is the testimony last of all which we give of her, that she lives."
Well, Maxine and Bella gave us some wonderful theory, and what I'm here to do today is to describe how certain women have translated that theory into their own reality. And these are women who have chosen not to doubt or to wait or to ask for permission, but have made the decision to create or to be receptive to their own spiritual lives and spiritual power. Many women have transcendent experiences. We all do. But once we come back down to earth, it is difficult to remember these experiences and to pin them down in our everyday language. One reason for this difficulty for women is that we lack models and we lack stories. We lack guides of our own to remind us of our own inner transcendent experiences. Another reason that we have difficulty with pinning these experiences down and translating them to each other using words is that our language has the images and words of male experience. And the words were designed to describe male experience. And we still lack the images and words to describe our own female experience. And I'm going to do the best I can today. Another reason why we often have difficulty is that we haven't given authority to those everyday acts that we have always been doing, such acts as the ability to connect with each other, to tune into our own intuition, to send our energy, to tune into our loved ones and our children, to trust what we know to be true, to listen to our dreams and images. I'm going to begin by relating one of my own experiences. This is an experience that I had about 2 years ago. This is when I was in San Francisco with a good friend of mine, and we had gone on a walk in a park, and we came by a museum. And so we went inside, and we had not planned to go into this museum, and it so happened they had an exhibit of Cycladic sculptures of the Mother God. And in this room we saw statue after statue, and they were all female. There were hundreds of them. They were simple, elegant marble statues. They represented this all-female force, a female incarnation that was at once life-giving, life-taking, and life-renewing. They were small forms, just about 7 inches high, very simple, very plain, and incredibly powerful. These holy objects were found in the tombs of both women and men. These early Greek artists, and we like to think that they were women, had created powerful spiritual symbols of life and death. Susan and I felt the force of these symbols, and we did not want to leave the room. And there was a time when we felt like we could not leave that room. We were entranced and ecstatic. We were at once overcome with the spirit of the objects. We couldn't yet put into words why this exhibit thrilled us so much and affirmed us so much. I felt as if I had been transported to a place and a time where feminine spirituality could flower as it never had before and probably never has since. Looking back, I feel that what I was longing for was a time and a place that valued femaleness and that saw femaleness as a powerful creative spiritual force. To leave that room, I would have to re-enter the everyday world where I felt that femininity had been trivialized, over-sexualized, and definitely misunderstood. Who was this goddess? I wanted to know. Who were these people that carved goddess after goddess? Who were these people that could not place a loved one in a tomb without a mother god image to show them the way to the other world? What did she mean to them? Also importantly, what does this goddess mean to me, to us as women today? How would I feel about myself if I had been raised with the image of an all-powerful mother god? How would I feel about myself, my life, my creativity, my worth, if I had been raised that way? I had asked many
women, mostly Mormon women, to share with me their experiences of the feminine deity, however they saw her, felt her, or understood her. And I also asked for them to provide any comments that they wanted to about that experience. Many of them wrote about the value of this part of their spiritual life. One woman told me that she felt that a relationship with God the Mother would give me a more of a sense of my eternal spiritual identity, essential to my self-esteem and to my self-knowledge. One woman remembered her patriarchal blessing that was given me even more than I care for my daughter, if that's possible, and I have shut her off from my life. She underlined the word I. It wasn't that the goddess had left her, but that she's the one who had neglected that relationship. Many women told me that they felt that their image of God the Father was a distant and fuzzy image, probably because they themselves had fathers who were distant emotionally or physically. Some women wrote and told me that they had been physically abused or emotionally or sexually abused by their fathers, and that made it even more problematic for them to image a male God, and they felt more compelling for them to establish a healing relationship with the female deity. One woman wrote to me saying, "I could use an exalted woman as a role model. Such a model would help me enjoy more fully my femaleness and my incredible worth." Another woman wrote, "I need to be comforted by a female." Another woman wrote, "As goddess is, as woman is, goddess once was. As goddess is, woman shall become." Women also sent me descriptions of how they imaged a mother god. One woman wrote that she saw a tall woman in a blue, rough, woven gown. Her hair is long and absolutely white from years and years of experience. Her eyes give away that she is old, older than anyone I have ever met, wiser than anyone. Her mouth is wide and generous. The ends turn up easily because she sees the humor and compassion and wisdom and love. She has learned to live simply. Another woman wrote, "My image of a woman god was always one of a strong-bodied, strong-minded, strong-willed, emotionally strong, yet tender woman." This woman needs a strong female image, obviously. "A woman who was unquestioningly equal with her partner, a woman who could and would communicate with her daughters." Another woman, this one is an artist, a sculptor, and she wrote about being in a guided imagery situation. She said, "I was confronted by a large, luminous woman, approximately 8 feet tall, clearly an image of a goddess. Her hair was light itself. As she came close to me, I was filled with both awe at her beauty and terror at her presence. If I were to take her into me, I know my life would be altered. I would have to give up many of the masculine modes I had adopted in order to negotiate successfully in the world. The woman was powerful, but her power was of receptivity, resonance, magnetism, and radiance. She drew me to her." This woman, after she wrote that, said that her art was never the same because of that image, that she could no longer sculpt using male forms or male ideas. And it's true that the pieces that I've seen from her were intensely female, and she was coming from a very female place. Another image that I'm getting a lot from women is the excitement they see as they pick up on these ideas. For most of us adults, ideas of the mother god, or using words like mother god, feminine deity, feel to us as if we're speaking in a second language, as if we had to learn this language and learn this image. But for children, it's different. Children are used to having two parents. And most children who have just one parent, well, it's the mother that they usually have. And so as we allow our children to connect with a female deity, our children begin teaching us how natural this is and how silly it is for us to feel unnatural about it or for us to feel guilty or covert about this relationship that we have. One woman, Andrea Amott, wrote in the Mormon Women's Forum newsletter about how her daughter had drawn pictures in the flyleaf of a Book of Mormon. And she writes this as a letter to her daughter. She says, "I came over for a closer look at your picture as you continued to explain that the book already had a picture of Heavenly Father in it." Well, that picture actually was Jesus, but the little girl didn't know. "So you had to put Heavenly Mother in too, as though the book was broken and had to be fixed. On the page opposite Heavenly Mother, You had drawn a rectangular shape, and I asked you what it was. You answered, Heavenly Mother's door. It was a while before I was able to ask you why Heavenly Mother has or needs a door. She just does, you said. And to me, that was an incredible story about this little girl fixing the Book of Mormon. I do believe that it needs a lot of fixing, and that's a good start. And this was a little girl who, she totally intuited the concept of a mother in heaven, and she also totally saw that there was something wrong with this book, page after page of men, and she wanted to fix it. The image of a powerful mother God is also inspiring many women to use their powers of healing and to accept healing from other women. One woman wrote to me telling me that she wrote, 6 months ago I received and gave a blessing, all women. The spiritual effect was tremendous. I felt validated, loved, valued. And the other sister who was physically ill was healed. I feel this is my beginning of experience with Mother in Heaven, for there was a great feeling of female power. Now when I read that, I thought to myself, I would so like to be in a circle like that. I don't know if I'm ready to be the voice, but I would love to be in a circle like that. And it was as if that thought created the reality, because a few months later, I did have the opportunity to be in a circle of women who were performing a healing blessing upon another woman. And the woman who had requested the blessing, well, she was pregnant, and one thing that she wanted was that her delivery would be delayed until she made an extra long car trip. And to me, it seemed so perfect and so right that this was a group of women. We understood the position she was in. Many of us had been in that position. And the love was just beautiful in that room. Several months after that, I myself had the experience to receive a blessing from women. And at that point, I was 9 months pregnant. And it turned out that I was about a week away from giving birth. And I was at a friend's house, and we were having a party for people who had volunteered in the Carolyn Pearson play Mother Wove the Morning. And as the party kind of dwindled down and there were just a few of us left, we were sitting in a circle and we were going through some guided imagery and passing energy around and doing some different things to get in touch with some of the spiritual power that was in the room. And at that point I felt, well, I would really like to have these women lend their energy to me, because I know I'm about to go through a very difficult experience. And just as I thought that, two other women said, we ought to do something for Martha. So what happened was we sat in a circle, and every woman had a chance to give a blessing or a promise or a hope that she had for me and for my child. And it was just the most incredible experience that I had had. And as you recall, that group of women and men were assembled. At that point, it was just a group of women, were assembled because all of us had participated in that incredibly powerful play about a goddess. For these women that I have talked about, the image of God the Mother has been very redemptive for them. It's redeemed them out of a myopic patriarchal consciousness, and it's helped them to step into their own spiritual power. And once we felt spiritually empowered, we felt empowered in all areas of our lives. For a woman, the discovery of the goddess within opens wellsprings of her being and leads to the release of creative energies of which she may not have been aware. The female has been so long repressed in this culture at large that the very language in which the women spoke, the images through which they expressed their inner being, were almost totally lost. Tilly Olson writes of the silences, the poems not written, the songs not sung. And right now we're prepared, and we are writing those poems and singing those songs and celebrating our Mother in Heaven. And I want to celebrate her and all of her works around me. I want to hear her voice within me. And I want to, no one else has the answers for me and for my life. And most of the time when I've tried to get an answer, I have been like Jacob in that I had to wrestle with the angel all night long until the morning to get my answer and to get my blessing. But unlike Jacob, who was a product of a patriarchal culture, the voice that I will hear and the blessing that I will receive will be intensely female. And like the poet Nosaki Shang, I want to be able finally to say, I found God in myself and I loved her fiercely. Thank you.
I think we have some time, probably 20 minutes, for any questions. Before we go to questions, though, and before too many people leave, I brought a survey to be handed out for you to pick up when you leave if you're interested. Martha and I both have been conducting some surveys, and I'm currently conducting one. It calls for women's personal descriptions of their mother in heaven. And I'm not sure where they are. You have them? Oh, great. Do you want to put them at the back of the room so that people can pick them up? Feel free to take several copies. There's a whole stack of them. And currently, we're soliciting women's personal descriptions, and then after we see how that goes and get enough of them, then later on, there may be an opportunity to compile these vignettes into a book. And at that point, I think we'll be seeking men's personal descriptions as well. Anybody have any questions for any of the three panelists? Comments? Have we left you all stunned in your seats or bored? Yes, right there.
I'd like to ask Martha if any of the women have dualistic images of God.
You know, what I saw a lot, women that talked about the Father God as well as the Mother God, I saw a pattern where several of them were saying that the Father God to them was some kind of an outer voice and the Mother God was an inner voice. Or several of them felt that it was a different quality of power. For some of these women, particularly the ones that were describing some kind of poor or non-existent or abusive relationship with their own father, it appeared to me that they weren't looking in that direction anymore, that they were looking solely to a Mother God. So you see all kinds of patterns there. Oh, I see what you're saying. There aren't, but I think the reason there aren't is because I didn't structure a question to ask for that. But I think you would see that.
By inner voice, did you mean to imply intuitional?
Well, I'm not trying to imply anything. One woman...
You said outer as contrasted with inner?
Several women wrote about... That the Mother God for them was an inner voice and that the Father God was an outer voice. Now, I'm not going to say if they meant intuition or what. Maybe some women are defining their intuition as that. But I feel like I'm more reflecting what I read.
Is it the old dichotomy of reason and intuition that they're talking about, do you think? I mean,
well, if they're saying that the Father God was an outer voice that they heard, I don't know if they found that voice that rational or that reasonable. I really don't know. Oh, when I went into that museum?
Oh, when you went
to it was a museum. I was in San Francisco and I wandered into a museum. Yeah.
I don't know. I can't.
Whatever you say won't get picked up unless I repeat it, and I promise not to repeat it.
I am on another vibration. I am on a celestial vibration, and I really...
Thank you for sharing that experience. We've still got about another 10 or 15 minutes, but before I call the next question, I wanted to address this gentleman's question earlier. This survey has been ongoing. And Martha and I have sent out a number of surveys, and I actually have received one or two versions or personal descriptions of the goddess as actually not being specifically male or female, but actually sort of androgynous. Yeah. So they're coming in. I mean, this survey is very much in process. And in fact, one of the reasons that we're handing out copies here today is so that we can circulate these more and get many, many more responses. Get all of your personal descriptions and intuitions and inspirations about this. Yep. It's Vella Evans. Vella. Yeah.
Did you have any knowledge of any resistance to
the... She asked me if I had any knowledge of any resistance to the demise of the Relief Society magazine. The research that I did... And the paper that I presented is a very small part of that research. The research that I did was in official public documents. I wanted to know what the Mormon culture looked like, and I wanted to have very accessible information. And so I looked at only published information, nothing that was locked away, nothing that was in any vaults, nothing that was in any private minutes. I have only apocryphal tales to tell, and I'm resistant to telling those kinds of tales. I don't have, certainly not in the public discourse. The only discourse I found that had any resistance to what was going on was in some of the Relief Society magazine, or some of the Relief Society minutes, which then were published. And in the published minutes, you can find some resistance. But that ends by the mid-1930s. And I don't have anything that's published in the late 1960s. It was 1970 when the magazine was discontinued, and the news about its upcoming demise was not more than 6 to 8 months before it actually occurred. I don't know.
That's why we're meeting here today.
The women I know who serve in general presidencies and on general boards have not succeeded.
I think we've all endeavored today to try to affirm the authorship and authority of women without denigrating or devaluating men as much as we possibly could. But I think it's but I think it's important to note, as you've noted and as we've noted, that the male and the female within each of us, as well as the humble and the childlike, are all components that are there. It's just that authorship or authority has not really manifested itself to the degree that it ought to. Paul, yeah.
One of the things that I've noticed at Sunstone over the years is that we have a marked preference for the scholarly, rational, and kind of academic approach, which in a sense is in itself a bias for the masculine over the feminine, more intuitive and personal. So I always like coming to these sessions that are about women about women's issues, because people tend to be a little bit more personal in their remarks, and I feel a little bit more comfortable about being so now. I would just like to very briefly relate the earliest dream that I can recollect, which for some reason came to mind when the woman was, sister was consent to bearing her testimony to us about the fact that the Holy Ghost is the female goddess, something which I personally accept. But it was a dream that I had when I was, I can't remember when I was, it was a repeated dream, it was the earliest dream that I can recall, and I recall being in the foyer of a very large house, where there was a very large staircase leading upstairs, and it was made all of oak and wood, and I went upstairs, and it was well lit. The thing that I remember are these great arched windows with clear glass, square panes of glass, and through this glass would shine this most wonderful light. And in these rooms was an immense library. I must have been maybe 4 or 5 years old when I had this dream. And it would, corridor after corridor of the most splendid books that I had ever seen. And the light flooding in, and it was a warm place, and I was very happy there. And then I remember that by some means of locomotion that I don't understand, I descended into the basement of this house. And this basement held no terror for me. It was a cave. And in this cave, there was a great treasure. And it was a kind of a pirate's cave for me. And it was very exciting, and I loved this cave. And it was very cool, and there was water and stalactites, and this feeling of coolness. And in there was my cousin. And my cousin was born just a month after I was. Her name was Angela. I named my first daughter after her. Tragically, she died of spinal meningitis when I was in college. But I was in this cave, and there she was, this female kind of guarding this treasure. And then, by the same mysterious power of locomotion, I was transported out of the house in a wood. And I could see the whole of the house from this woods. I could see the part that was above all well lit, and I could see it resting somehow on this cave that was dark where my cousin and this treasure was. And in a sense, I think this dream somehow embodies my own spiritual journey, that in my early life I was extremely attracted to the patriarchal, the rational, the scholarly. But as I have grown older, I have found that beneath this there is an intuitive cave, a place where the feminine is, and a great treasure is hidden.
Thank you for sharing that. We hope that as you share these, you'll consider picking up a survey in the back of the room and writing these down and sending them to us so we can compile them. There's a comment here and then yours. And you.
I just wanted to underscore and highlight the word androgynous.
Mm-hmm.
Because to me, if you're going to envision father, obviously there's a mother. I would rather we would address our author, who are to we suppose in heaven, and of course we're authoring our own imaginative trips wherever we're going anyway. But all this pull and tug, female against male, to me is just a terrible flurry of foolishness and aggression, and I think it's high time we just quit it.
Mm-hmm. Well, hopefully the concepts of feminism or being female and hominism, being male, can flow together, coexist simultaneously, and create a third dimension. Let's see, who is, you were next, and then now we have all kinds of questions.
I just wondered how it relates to being home. It's just great.
Thank you. Will you write this down? Okay, you and then you. Got about six more minutes, so keep your comments brief if possible.
I was saddened to have Sister Barbara Smith be released as the Relief Society president.
Do you want to address this question, Bella? Pass it off to you.
You want to get hold of the paper that was presented at 8:30 this morning on the Relief Society, and Yvonne Miller, who?
Wright. Yvonne Wright.
Yvonne Wright traced some of the structural changes in the Relief Society. All of the Relief Society presidents were put into office for the period of their life, as were General Church presidents when Joseph, under Joseph's direction, the Relief Society was established in Nauvoo. They were told at that time that the women should serve in good faith for the period of their lifetime, and they did until Emmeline Wells in 1921, and she was released from office. She was the first Relief Society president to be released from office. This is only my personal sense of it. My personal sense is that it's now convenient to rotate those offices just periodically so that the rotation becomes natural. I don't know that Barbara Smith was particularly feminist. In the program this morning, Sister Wright said she thought that Belle Spafford was the last real feminist.
Yes, as Bella mentioned, women have sought unofficial publications after the demise of the official ones, but I think we need official publications as well.
How was the journal discontinued?
The Young Women's Journal was really struggling financially, and it was becoming fairly feminist. It had been edited by Susie Young Gates at its inception, and then it was taken over by Alice Louise Reynolds, and they were both very strong women. Everything crashed a bit around the 1930s, and it merged actually with the Improvement Era in 1929. And in 1929, while the Improvement Era was supposed to be a general church magazine, it essentially was carrying mostly the music and the young men's program. And so it was pretty much taken over by the Young Men's Program. And in fact, the upcoming information in the Young Women's Journal talked about the marriage. Prince Era and Princess Journal uniting in marriage. But what happened was that was... And the first few issues actually gave equal space to the women's program as it gave to the men's program. But if you follow the Improvement Era from 1929, when it absorbed the Young Women's Journal, follow it throughout the next several years, you find a gradual diminishing of the women's issues and the women's interest in the Improvement Era, and a focusing and an emphasis on the men's issues. You talked about this unholy perception of female against male. That's the liberal feminist. You know, this is the kind of feminist that Maxine talked about, this is where we are. We're grinding these wheels because the structure is set up that way. So we're working within the structure. And to work within the structure, you have to talk male-female issues. And to avoid that, you have to buy another kind of feminism. You have to work within another kind of feminism, which avoids existing structures and takes on new conceptions.
I should add to that that I didn't mean to imply that all Mormon feminists fall into one category. Obviously, they don't. But when Mormon women struggle with the church as an institution, they are engaged in that particular feminist, the liberal cultural feminist struggle. I think we've got time for one more question, and then we're out of time. Back there. Thank you. Thank you very much for attending this session. And please, I guess those surveys are they on the floor or on a chair? Please pick up some surveys on the way out.